The dickheads are presented in color.
Frank has been a bucket list guest of mine. I think I have Facebook messages going back 2 years trying to nail down Frank to come on here and talk about the man, the myth, the legend, Philip K. Dick. Frank, tell the folks who you are and how did you become such a serious dickhead?
Well, if you want to make it relatively long, it really goes back. I grew up in the 70s and I was a math geek, and I became a big Trekkie. I was a big fan of Star Trek, but the videos weren't really that accessible. It wasn't showing all that often, so it actually became for me a reading experience. Like, I collected the books,
and like
the James Blish and the Alan Dean Foster. I picked it up right in the mid 70s when the Bantam novels were starting to come out slowly. And that was about the right speed for me, because although I was a big math nerd, I was, by science fiction fan standards, I was not a big precocious reader. So I read those books slowly, and that was my big thing. And then I gradually got into other SF movies, what eventually became known for a while, at least, as media SF. And then by the end of the 70s, there was kind of these crossovers, like, you know, I had the James Blish books, and Joe Haldeman had a couple of Star Trek novelizations. I'd heard of him, so I was kind of knew a little bit about what science fiction was like, you know, as a written medium. And the big thing for me, my Rosetta Stone, was the Science Fiction Encyclopedia edited by Peter Nichols, that came out in 1979, which I guess still exists.
John Clute, right?
And John Clute was a major contributor, but Peter Nichols was the one who originally edited it.
Yeah.
And
I'm working on getting Clute on this podcast, by the way.
Right. It came out in 1979, and is just, you know, from cover to cover, just very good, and had a lot of good bibliographic material in it. And but that was kind of my Rosetta Stone. Like, I could connect the
here's the movie. 95 version.
yeah, that's right. John Clute was by then the co-editor. And it exists online now, but I, for whatever reason, I'm not in the habit of consulting it.
It's an invaluable resource. I love it. I use it all the time.
Yeah. But it has very good critical judgment and also very good bibliographic information. So that was actually my first encounter with Philip K. Dick, because part of what I did was I learned about the Hugo Awards, and I figured, well, the Hugo Awards, that's the best stuff. I'll just collect these novels and, you know, read up about these people who won the Hugo Award. And so I think my first ever encounter with Philip K. Dick was reading about The Man in the High Castle and his biography, actually. And in the first paragraph, it's saying, you know, married 5 times, has 3 children, you know, all that kind of stuff, in addition to being a prestigious writer at the time. And that was before any of the Pink Bean stuff had gotten out publicly. So it was published in 1979, but his last novel essentially was Scanner Darkly. So it was like cautionary drug stuff. So between the cautionary drug stuff that's written up and the Married 5 Times, I always viewed Philip K. Dick as a cautionary tale. It's like, okay, maybe he's a great science fiction writer and I should investigate him, but I shouldn't really follow the man's wisdom necessarily. So I've always been like that to a certain extent. But anyway, I collected all of the Hugo winning novels. I didn't read them all. Maybe Lifetime, I've read a little more than half of them, you know, of up to that time. Certainly haven't read many since then. And so I collected Man in the High Castle, but I didn't read it, but I knew about it. And then the next step was, although I was mostly interested in novels, I kind of got it in my head that that was the good stuff. In high school, I read two key anthologies. I read this one, Science Fiction Hall of Fame, Volume 1, the one edited by Robert Silverberg. And
I'm
on the other end,
currently doing a series on my podcast, my other podcast, about that book. So
great. And at the other end of the spectrum, I was reading Dangerous Visions, the Harlan Ellison landmark volume from the 60s. And so I read all of those stories in those books. You know, Science Fiction Hall of Fame is very traditional stuff, you know, Golden Age, Astounding, and a fair number of stories, mostly from Galaxy in the 50s. And I think only one story from the 60s, like they managed to get a Zelazny story in there, but it was basically, it was sort of like a grand, like retro nebula, because they voted on the stories to include in it from, you know, when the nebulas were founded and CEPHA was founded, I think in 1965 or thereabouts. And so they kind of had a big vote of, well, what are the best science fiction stories ever? We'll publish some anthologies on that. And so I never got to reading through the volume 2 and A and 2B, which had all the novellas in it. That's still a bucket list thing for me, but I don't know if I'll ever get to it because it's been many decades. But anyway, so I read all that traditional stuff. But then on the other hand, I read Dangerous Visions, which was, you know, by then kind of old news, but it was the vanguard of the American New Wave. And so I kind of accepted both poles as being the state of the field, and that was reflected in anything I read in the Science Fiction Encyclopedia.
So was Faith of Your Fathers, was that really your entry point to PKD? Because I think that was Professor Wilson's as well.
That absolutely, unless I'm totally missing something, that was the first Philip K. Dick story I read, because he doesn't have any in Science Fiction Hall of Fame. And I know I read Dangerous Visions cover to cover. The story did not make a great impression on me one way or another. It was just another weird thing. And there's the biographical stuff in there about, oh, well, did he take LSD writing it or not? You know, stuff like that. But it was just another thing. The big thing then was by then I was subscribed to Starlog. That was my media SF entry point to kind of know what was going on. And the Blade Runner movie was coming. So that was another thing. I was like, okay. And there'd be interviews of Dick in there and such. And but still, I hadn't read Man in the High Castle. It was just something I collected, and I didn't get around to reading it. And in fact, when I became a big fan, I actually saved it. I was like, well, this is supposedly his best work. I'll kind of save it, and you know, when the time's right, I'll get to read this masterpiece. So anyway, in the run-up to Blade Runner, I knew that was coming. I was excited about it because that was a big new science fiction movie. Saw that on the day it opened, and I had collected Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep, you know, a paperback, you know, like not the Blade Runner cover version. I think I had the first paperback of it. And I'm pretty sure I read that same year. I don't think I read it before seeing the movie, because by then I had learned not to do that. It's like back during the 70s, part of what happened was the novelizations would be out before the movie, just to make sure they were in the bookstore. Like the Star Wars novelization, which I didn't know about Star Wars before it came out. I did see it when it first came out, but that novelization came out in 1976. But Star Trek the Motion Picture, which was the big thing for me as a Trekkie, the novelization was available before the movie came out, and I read it cover to cover before the movie came out. And so by the time Star Trek II came out in 1982, I'd convinced myself, no, I should watch the movie first. And so I did watch it, and then immediately that same weekend read the novelization. But anyway, for Blade Runner, I had the book, and I'm pretty sure I read it that year after seeing the movie. But again, I don't remember it making that big an impression on me. It was more like, okay, this is different from the movie, kind of interesting, but not any big thing. It's just another author I knew about. And so then we get in, and then by then I'm in college. And so in what did it for me in the spring of 1983, I was in an engineering school. I was an engineering student in upstate New York, and I took a science fiction class. It was called Science Fiction Probes. It was just kind of an intro survey course, and at an engineering college, tons of people registered for it because it was a chance to get credit for reading science fiction rather than other boring stuff. And
how Professor Wilson gets students.
Yes.
No, now you can't get students to take anything.
And the,
those days are over.
And so the syllabus was the kind of core of it was this book, The Road to Science Fiction number 3 from Heinlein to Here.
Oh,
which was edited by James Gunn, not the Hollywood James Gunn, the the science fiction writer academic James Gunn. And in that is We Can Remember It For You Wholesale, the book that Total Recall was inspired. But in addition to that, and we read that almost cover to cover, but in addition to that, we featured various authors reading their novels and some stories, you know, just a selection. And those featured authors were H.G. Wells, Arthur C. Clarke, Ursula K. Le Guin, and Philip K. Dick. And so for Philip K. Dick, we read Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep? And we read Martian Timeslip, because aside from them those being good Dick novels, they were in print, and you could get enough copies of them for the class to have them. But we also read a number of his stories, I think probably all of them from the best of Philip K. Dick, the 1970s Ballantine collection.
Oh, okay.
And they were just photocopied and on reserve at the library, which is the worst way to read something for pleasure. But there were several stories from that that stuck with me. I'm pretty sure I had read Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep. I hadn't read Martian Timeslip, so I read that. But the ones that really kind of stuck with me were The Days of Perky Pat and either Second Variety or Impostor, maybe both. But especially the Perky Pat one, I was reading that, and it was just so twisted. It was weird, and it was weird in the same way that Scanners Live in Vain, which I'd read from the Science Fiction Hall of Fame. Like
Cordwainer Smith. Yeah.
Cordwainer Smith. It's like if Cordwainer Smith had the same career as, you know, lengthy career that Dick had had, I might have read that and think, I ought to try some more of that. And it was a similar thing with Dick. It was like, wow, this is really odd stuff, but it's still recognizably science fiction. And another thing was I had classmates, so, you know, we'd compare notes on these things, and they weren't getting it, or at least it wasn't appealing to them, at least, and it was to me. So that was kind of like a flag that went up. It was like, huh, maybe I should get into this because I'm seeing something. And Dick obviously had a reputation, and he was respected enough academically that he was being covered in this course. And so I had classmates who were really into the tech stuff, like they were really into the Arthur C. Clarke, wanted to read about spaceships and things. And I had read Arthur C. Clarke. The books, I'm pretty sure we read for that class, were Childhood's End and Rendezvous with Rama, which I had read both of them and not really been into. And they were into that kind of stuff.
Well, Rendezvous with Rama didn't blow you away with its dynamism and excitement. And
not at all.
One of the most boring books I've ever read in my life. I got to the end of it, like, Jesus Christ.
Well, now,
so Frank's a good writer, but, you know.
So,
I tried Childhood's End a little while ago, and I couldn't get through the first two chapters. It was just, oh.
I will defend Childhood's End thematically is great, but it is what it is. But, Greg, so from that point, from that class, and I'll tell everybody a story of how I basically came to know Frank, was there was one time I sent a message on Facebook to David Gill, friend of the podcast, and I said, I wonder if there's a way to know if Phil went to the after party at Worldcon, and I think it was 64, or whatever year it was in the Bay Area. And he said, you should ask Frank Hollander. and I was like, who? And then he's like, Frank Hollander. This was several years ago. And then he was like, yeah, ask Frank. He's your best bet. So we've gone from you first reading him in this class. Like, how did you get involved in the Dick community? Like, where did that come from?
Like, okay, so where it went from there was... I was in the bookstore at the small bookstore at my college that had a fairly traditional paperback rack, and they'd have the latest stuff, but they couldn't keep a big stock of anything. And that same spring, I saw a book called The Transmigration of Timothy Archer by Philip K. Dick. I was like, huh, that's interesting. I picked it up. It's like, this is the same guy. I guess I'll buy it. And so I read it, and like the first chapter, it's got the stuff about John Lennon's murder. And like that was something I experienced. That was a few years ago. That was recent history, and you know, the whole book was kind of mainstream for the most part. And I read through it, and I liked it enough. It wasn't quite up my alley, but it showed the range of the guy. And I thought, well, I should get into this more. And the thing about the science fiction encyclopedia was it pretty much would have full bibliographic information on all the authors sprinkled through it one way or another. So I had the list of his novels. And at that point, I just started slowly collecting them. And that same year, 1983, the Worldcon was in Baltimore, and I was from Baltimore, and so I went to the Worldcon, and there was a panel on Philip K. Dick that I just sort of showed up at, like, yeah, I guess I ought to go to that. It wasn't a well-attended, or there wasn't a big panel. All I really remember was that Norman Spidrad was on it, and I know from the schedule that Paul Williams was on it, but I don't really remember Paul Williams as a, you know, as a person, you know, up there speaking, but he must have been. And I probably missed half of it. And at least half of it, I didn't know what they were talking about.
But hey, towards Frank, what year was this, mid 80s?
No, 1983.
Okay.
1983, Worldcon in Baltimore.
Got it.
And I had been to, Star Trek conventions, and I had been to some occasionally local science fiction conventions, like Balticon was the Baltimore area one, but I had never been to anything anywhere near a Worldcon, and so that was a big thing for me to get to go to that. So I was doing all kinds of stuff, but so I went to that, and the two things I remember from that panel were, towards the end of it, someone in the audience asked Norman Spinrad, you know, could you talk about your personal relationship with Philip K. Dick? And he said, no, I'm not going to do that. And I think the guy in the audience said, oh, why not? He said, because I don't want to. You know,
Norman Spidrad.
You know, you've had a much older Norman Spidrad, you know, as an interviewee, so you kind of understand that.
Well, our interview started with him telling me my first question was stupid. So.
Yep.
right. And to Spinrad's credit, he did eventually write about his relationship with Philip K. Dick, but for whatever reason, he didn't want to talk about it then. And so I remember that. And I also remember someone from the audience asked, what's that book you were holding up earlier, which I hadn't noticed. And they held up the book, which I don't have a copy of to show to our video audience. It was the Underwood Miller bibliography, the one that I think was published in 1981 while Dick was still alive with his cooperation. And I just kind of, this is the wisest thing I've ever done, pretty much. I saw that, and they said, oh, this is Underwood Miller, whatever. You can pick it up in the dealer's room. And the wisest thing I ever did was I thought, I think I'm going to need that. And so I walked out of that room, the conference room, whatever it was, walked straight to the dealer's room, found the book, and bought it, which is a fairly extravagant buy at the time, but I thought I needed it, and sure enough, I did. And so also at the same time, I had somewhere along, I think in 1982, in the middle of 1982, I had subscribed to Locus magazine. And so I was plugged into all things science fiction. As it turned out, it was right after Philip K. Dick had died, and I just missed all the appreciations and stuff that they published, but it was still recent news. I had known he had died because it was in the mainstream press. I think I had seen a notice in like Time magazine or something. So I at least I knew that. But anyway, within Locus, occasionally would be mentioned the Philip K. Dick Society, which I think started up by Paul Williams in early 1983, probably. And so I was aware of that. I didn't join right away or subscribed or whatever they called it, but I was an early subscriber. It's like issue number 4 was the current issue when I joined, which was maybe by the end of 83 or early 84. And so I was plugged into all the new stuff that was being released, all the interviews that were published in there. And I knew about all the mainstream books that were gradually coming out, some of the reprints. And so, you know, we're talking about puttering about in a small land today. I knew that that was coming out. And, you know, in the society newsletter, we'd get like offers to buy it. I don't think it was one that I ordered through the mail or anything, but I was aware of these mainstream novels. And as it turned out, I got a very eclectic introduction to Philip K. Dick, because I'd had that, the academic side. And I just sort of read what I found. And part of what I found were the books that were coming out then, which were some of the lesser novels that were coming out in repeats, like Dr. Futurity and the Unteleported Man, the expanded version, which I do actually like quite a bit, but nonetheless, that's not considered a major Philip K. Dick novel, things like that. And just whatever I collected, you know, used books. And
were you reading the mainstream novels as they were posthumously published in their first editions?
More or less. I mean, not the day they came out, but there were 6 that came out between 84 and 88. And I read all of them within a few years of their release.
Okay.
And so that was definitely my introduction to the mainstream. But I was also reading his major novels like Ubik, and I read Flow My Tears, and I finally did read The Man in the High Castle. So I was getting a mix of all sorts of things. And one of the odd things was I was reading the society newsletters, and they had interviews with kind of the principal people in his life in the Orange County years, and who were fictionalized in Valis. And I guess, I don't know if they were fictionalized in any of the others, but anyway, And so I read all this stuff about Valis, but I hadn't read it yet. And in fact, I'm pretty sure in one of the science fiction magazines, I had read a short, like Asimov's or something, I had read a short capsule review that said, well, this is kind of odd. This isn't really for beginners, but maybe if you're a real Dick fan, you might like it. And so I was aware of this odd book, but I was scared away from it. But then I read all this stuff about, you know, all the background on it. And so during that period, I did read it, but that was a very odd way to get an introduction to that, like to have all this details about, you know, like what K.W. Jeter had to say about the whole thing. So
personally, anyway, I find that view wrong entirely. I mean, you can read Valis, the first book. It doesn't matter if you know anything about Philip K. Dick. It's still a good book on its own. So
yeah, it's certainly an approachable book, whether it's, you know, especially the first few chapters, it's just, you know, brilliant writing.
The themes are so broad that anybody can pick it up and know what it's about.
Whether you'd bounce off it or not, whatever, who knows, but whatever little review I read was definitely from a traditional science fiction perspective. And
yeah, I've heard that review.
Certainly back then it was very new to be talking about Philip K. Dick as someone interested in mystical and religious experiences. That, you know, although he had written it several years earlier, it did not come out until early 1981. Right. And so he only had a year of, I mean, he had some interview or something that hinted at it. Like the Charles Platt thing might have been published by then. But
that was
kind of new in the Philip K. Dick fan world to deal with that. And then shortly after he died, and then, you know, this is the period I was talking about. So anyway, I collected the novels and I was gradually reading them. By 1986, the next Worldcon I went to, which was in Atlanta, that was the point I had collected them all. And the big point then was I collected in Milton Lumpke territory, which was a $30 book. and that was a big hurdle to overcome, the, you know, just buying this book that, you know, it was just sort of the faith that, yes, I would read it and wouldn't be disgusted that I'd spent that money on something that might be his 30th best book or something.
Yeah, right.
And, you know, $30 in the mid-80s is like $80+ now. That's an extravagant thing to be buying just to complete your Philip K. Dick collection. But anyway, that was the point that I finished the collection. And so anyway, I've been reading ever since. I really slowed down quite a bit in the 90s, but I eventually went into computers, so I was into email, you know, from the mid 80s off and on. I didn't have to wait for the World Wide Web. So I was in on mailing lists. I wasn't always that active, but I was kind of plugged into fan communities. And I started doing a little fan writing occasionally, I guess by the end of the 90s. And the things I did.
Well, you're really known for internet sleuthing, for finding things. And that's one of the reasons why, like, a lot of times on the Facebook groups, if we want to find something out, you know, Gil and I joke about how this, you know, this is a mission for Frank Hollander, you know.
Yeah. Well, I always approached it as a completist. I wanted everything. So I wanted to collect all the novels. I don't know how I would have collected all the stories back in the 80s if I hadn't known from very early on that they were working on collected stories. So, like, I had that big bibliography, and it has all the stuff about the stories, and I knew that about half of them, or at least a solid third, were not collected. And I wouldn't have known how to find those. So, anyway, that was part of it, was that I collected everything. And by the time the World Wide Web came along, and you could order books online, That kind of reopened it for me. It's like that was the first time I was aware that Ann Dick's memoir biography had actually been released, and I was able to order a copy of that and get some other obscure things. And I don't know quite the sequence of it, but at a certain point in there, I got interested in the actual original magazine appearances. And so I started collecting them, and I also just got fascinated by the feel of these old pulp magazines, which most of Dick's stories were not what were not published in actual pulps, but a few of them were. And in his first story, Beyond Lies the Wub, or the first published story, Beyond Lies the Wub, was published in Planet Stories, which was one of the old pulps dating back before the war. And this was a whole world that I had read about, but I'd never really held these magazines in my hand. So I just sort of obsessively collected them, which was possible to do back then without spending huge amounts of money. It's still not massively collectible now, but some of them are fairly scarce. And so from there, I started trying to collect rarities, and I that's when the internet sleuthing went on. Like one of the things I did was his last published short story, The Alien Mind, was first published in a high school newspaper. And it turned out I wasn't the first person to know about this, the actual story behind it. But at the time, it was hard to figure it out. The story, the spoiler of it is what had happened was Dick's priest moved to Yuba City, which is, in northern central California somewhere, and Dick stayed in contact with him, and the priest's son somehow wrote to Dick asking to help contribute something to his school newspaper. Somehow that happened, and Dick sent him this little story, maybe like four, maybe 1,000 words, something like that, just a very short story. And it turned out it was published in this high school newspaper, and like in early 1981, and then later in the year it was published in FNSF. And the blurb in FNSF said something like, "Dick wrote this story because someone in line at the pet food store asked him for a story." Some odd thing like that, which was totally bogus, but at least had some connection to it. It was just some odd thing that someone had asked for. And so anyway, I was obsessively collecting, and I went through I don't think it was classmates.com, but it was like the whatever the major like alumni social media sites were at the time, in what was still fairly early worldwide web. And I was contacting graduates of this school, Yuba City High School, and said, "I know this is a real long shot, but do you have any of this? Do you know anything about this, et cetera?" This story that, the bibliographies at least nailed down when it was published, but the circumstances of it were rather mysterious, at least to me. And by a miracle, I contacted someone, and they said, "Oh yeah, I looked in my garage. I've got a few of those issues, and yeah, I got your story right here."
Nice.
I didn't want to like ask to buy it or anything. I wasn't treating it as like I was a big treasure hunter. I just wanted to have the text in front of me. And so I talked them into photocopying the whole high school newspaper, which was eight large pages. And so I have that, and I also made contact with that student at the time. His name was Ben Adams, and I learned the whole story. And anyway, I got him to write a little piece about it, and I wrote a little piece that was published in PKD Otaku, which is the the PKD fanzine that Patrick Clark founded and still edits, although it's now kind of a fancier thing that he gets some help editing. But anyway, I had written a couple things before then, but that was my big entry into like the big time of you know, fandom of like, oh, I, you know, actually did something that was worth publishing. And so I went from there and did some other kind of things. The next big stop was in 2010, the first PKD festival that that David Hyde organized in Colorado. It turned into a pretty small gathering, but I happened to learn about it. I was very fortunate I had time to go do it a weekend. And that's where I met David Gill and Perry Kinman and a few of the other big active fans at the time. And that just sort of energized me. That was got me more involved with trying to keep in touch with people. And then the next year, David Gill was organizing the conference at his college, Cal State Fullerton, and he was also, or not Cal State Fullerton, San Francisco State University,
yeah,
but part of the Cal State system, but in San Francisco. But he was also the day before he was doing his first tour of walking tour of Berkeley, and I had not been to Northern California at all, except maybe passing through the airport. Maybe, I'm not even sure of that. So this was a big thing for me. And so in preparation for that, I was rereading the biographies, which I hadn't read in a long time, and was kind of soured on that whole approach to things, in part because Greg Brickman there'd been all the mudslinging against him, and it just kind of became a contentious issue, all this biographical stuff. And the Dick Society newsletter had shut down. So there wasn't much active going on other than just fans talking among themselves. So anyway, I reread the biographies and was focused on the Berkeley part of the story. And there were two threads I picked up on that I wanted to dig into while I was there. One was there was this mysterious first wife, Jeanette Marlin. And there was very sketchy information about her in the bios. It was like, well, she was this older woman that somehow he got involved with. And I had made an offhand comment in some of the discussions then about, well, we don't really need another fan biography. What we need is some professional biographer who knows how to dig into like legal records and census records and stuff like that. And then from there, I was thinking, huh, census records. I'm kind of curious. I bet I could find some census records online. Maybe, you know, maybe I could do that. And it turned out this was 2012. That was the, you know, we just recently went through 2022, the 1950 census records were released. Well, back then in 2012, the 1940 census records had been released. And so that was kind of the heart of Dick's childhood. So anyway, part of what I did was just searching for records, and I found Jeanette Marlin's family in those census records. And lo and behold, she was not much older than Dick, you know, just less than 3 years older than him. Like she was maybe 21 when they married, something like that. And so from there, one of the things I wanted to do was, I also had heard that, well, the Berkeley Public Library had all of the high school yearbooks from that era. I said, well, I'll just go through these yearbooks. Maybe I'll find something of Dick that the biographers didn't have, and I'll look up his friends, and I'll try to find Jeanette Marlin. And I did that. And so another thing I wanted to do was his childhood stories that he had published in something called the Berkeley Gazette or the Berkeley Daily Gazette. There was some confusion about that in the bios. And it was stories that he had published in the daily newspaper in Berkeley, the Berkeley Daily Gazette. There was this really daily column that one of the editors there, Florida Cook, who went by the name Aunt Flo, editing these columns. She had grade school students of all ages. They'd submit stories and she'd publish them and critique them and all that stuff. Dick had a number of stories, and his biographers had access to I think his scrapbook where he'd saved all this stuff. And Greg Rickman at least had gone to the microfilm and maybe some of the bound volumes to look for other stuff. And he'd gone down this rabbit hole of thinking that Dick had also written these stories under the pen name Teddy in this Young Authors Club column in the Berkeley Daily Gazette, which in my research, I'm 100% convinced he was totally wrong. But anyway, I wanted to investigate all that stuff. And I found a fair amount of it on Google newspapers that had been digitized. But there's a fair amount that were in issues that where there were gaps, and especially some of these Teddy stories, they hadn't been stories and poems. They hadn't been digitized. So anyway, I had a mission to look some of this stuff on microfilm at the Berkeley Public Library and look at their bound volumes for 1945 for some of this material. So I had all this stuff and just a few hours to do it in before this walking tour of Berkeley. And I arrived the night before, like the Thursday night, checked into like a Motel 6 or something like that in Berkeley. It was the first time I'd been there. And I had these few intense hours of research at the library. I found some things on microfilm. I photographed some things in their bound volume, pretty much accomplished what I wanted from that. I took photos of the yearbooks, like of his childhood friends who had, you know, had been featured in the biographies, especially Rickman's, like George Kohler, you know, people like that. You know, just seeing pictures of these people I found very interesting. I did not find Jeanette Marlin. But after I went home, I figured out that there was this other junior high that I didn't really know about, that there were also some yearbooks, and because most of the yearbooks were from Berkeley High where Dick went, but he went to a junior high, I think it was Garfield, I might be mixing that up. There was another one, and it turned out Jeanette Marlin had gone there, and by contacting the librarians, I had them look through these junior high yearbooks, because she was not in the high school yearbook. I to this day I don't know if she graduated from high school, just was missing for some reason. But anyway, they found the yearbook, the junior high yearbook that she was in, and I got them to mail me a photocopy of her photo, which was totally breaking new ground. Now, right. I'll say to our listening audience, all of those yearbooks have been digitized, and they're all on archive.org. Everything, I'm pretty sure, that's at Berkeley Public Library, their collection was digitized. So you can go through all those high school yearbooks and whatever junior high yearbooks there were. But anyway, that I wrote up an article about that, you know, my discoveries about Jeanette Marlin. And what was the other thing? I edited a whole book that I self-published of the Young Authors Club's stories. I called it Young Authors Club, The Wartime Adolescence Writings of Philip K. Dick. And I published it just here in the U.S., in part because another thing I had done throughout all these years was I'd done some copyright research. And I was really the first person to at least publicize the fact that some of Dick's early stories were pretty much in the public domain in the US because the copyrights hadn't been renewed at the end of his life. And there's another batch that weren't renewed properly after he died. But anyway, that's a whole big can of worms. So that was another thing I had done much more quietly before 2010. I had looked that up recently because Project Gutenberg first published Beyond Lies the Wub in 2009 as a public domain story. And I found out recently that they'd published their first story in a while by Philip K. Dick last year, the Prize Ship. But anyway, I was the one who set that in motion. I had known this for a while when I was collecting. Part of what I did was I looked up just bibliographically, I was interested in publication dates. And so I'd looked up the catalog of copyright entries where most of the stories, you know, they've got a specific publication date because the magazines had to register their, you know, the date of publication, all that kind of stuff. But I had also figured out some had been renewed and some hadn't. And I'd kind of been sitting on that information for a while. And eventually I realized I'm too busy. I can't really do much with this. And there was this organization, distributed processing something, Project Gutenberg. Anyway, there's this organization that's still around that their mission is to kind of do crowdsourcing to help proofread books that they're going to submit to Project Gutenberg. Like they first research something's in the public domain, or it's obviously in the public domain because it's so old. And they've got this, you know, online web thing where they'll put up, you know, they'll do like the OCR to get, you know, a text. And then they'll do the kind of a crowdsourcing approach to get people to proofread individual pages. And I had done a little bit of that, and that dated back to the much earlier in the web era. But anyway, I got on their forum and I posted, this was in 2007, basically just did a dump of my research. I said, and I think at the time I knew they had started to publish some science fiction stuff. So I thought, you know, they're probably interested in this. And so I just dumped out my research and said, you know, I think a good chunk of these early stories, I think they're probably in the public domain. You might want to be interested in it. The guy who does most of that stuff, he didn't have time for it right away, but he said, as soon as I have time, I'll get on that. And so might have been the next year, he said, yeah, let's go if you can still help. Because I physically had all the copies of his first appearances. Because by then I pretty much had a complete collection of all of his fiction in first edition. So I was like, yeah, I'll scan this stuff for you. What do you want to do? I don't have time for anything else. And so most of the stories that Project Gutenberg published, it was from my scans. And from 2009 on, it was kind of a steady stream of them. And that had some unintended consequences. It caused a big stir, but the basic part of it, yeah, I'm really happy with, is that there's kind of this base of material that, like, people who are, you know, people can get into it for free. Like film students can make a short film about Beyond Lies the Wub. They don't have to worry about rights or anything like
yeah,
that.
There's tons of PDFs out there of Dick short stories and novels and everything.
Yeah. The flood of all the products that people create out of it wasn't really what I had in mind, but, and I'm sure that makes the heirs to all this unhappy, just to kind of have all that muddled. And then there's a whole issue of all the stories from 1954. I think I can say without being sued that they pretty much faked the copyright renewals
in
the same year that they had to, that they renewed the 1955 stories. They faked like, oh, we're renewing these stories, stories that were all published in 1954, that they had missed, that they should have renewed in 1982. They were renewing them in 1983 and kind of faking the publication dates. And that
we actually talked about that in Adjustment Bureau, but it was just so long ago that Larry doesn't remember.
Right. And so I don't know who was the first to know that, but I was certainly, I'm sure, the first person to make that public. And so word got out, and by then the Adjustment Bureau existed as a movie, and that was based on the story Adjustment Team, which was one of those 1954 stories. And so the producers, I guess, got wind of that, and they just say, no, we're not going to pay you anymore. And that turned into a federal lawsuit, and they settled it. So we don't know what happened. I assume the heirs mostly lost, but I'm pretty sure that worldwide rights are not necessarily in the public domain because of some oddities in the international treaties and things.
Yeah, you never know what each country is doing with rights.
Yeah. Like, so, that was why I was careful about my book to really only sell it in the U.S.
and
to certain countries. Like, I had read some sources that said, well, because of NAFTA, there's some provision that it's probably not in the public domain, stories from that era in Canada, and there's some particular law in the U.K., so I wouldn't send stuff to the U.K. But
yeah, you don't want to mess with U.K. copyright laws. They're insane.
Yeah, and so anyway, I was a person who kind of let that stuff loose. I'm sure that it would have happened eventually because there was enough interest in these genre stories that clearly the copyrights hadn't been renewed and that were in the public domain in the U.S. But anyway, that was part of my obsessive research that went into all this. I didn't write articles about it, and it got published in PKD. The Otaku. So anyway, the back to the Berkeley thing. Flowing out of that research, I wrote articles about Jeanette Marlin, and I continued research on this book that I eventually self-published. And I just got to be known as the person who obsessively would know all these details.
That was a great thing.
Well, I don't necessarily remember everything.
Super fan, they call you.
Yeah.
Well,
it's kind of continued to this day, and I feel a little odd about it because I like if we're talking about the novels and the stories, I forget stuff almost as soon as I've read it. Like I reread Puttering for this episode, and I had reread it a few years ago. Lots of stuff I just don't remember from it, but
I do that all the time. I forget at the moment it entered my head.
But
let's get back on track on that, Frank. We might have to pull this out and make your part.
Make it a special interview episode. Of Frank.
It will be.
But anyway, that pretty much gets us to today.
We should consider doing a special on all that copyright stuff.
Yeah, you should come back and we'll talk just about that.
We'll do a deep dive into that, into that whole winding story of the copyrights and everything.
Yeah, but anyway, that pretty much gets us to today. We can talk about the book if you actually want to talk about the book.
Well, first we got to do PKD news.